Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Kickstarter Spotlight episode, and today I'm joined by comic creator Steve Bryant to talk about his current Kickstarter campaign, Athena Voltaire and the Terror on the Orient Express. So, Steve, thanks for taking the time to join me.
Hi, thanks for having me, and I really like your background.
Ah, yeah, it's nice. Everybody, if you can see that, it's some of the art from Athena Voltaire. And if you've been around comics for a while, you may have heard of Athena Voltaire. It's a property that's been around the brainchild of Steve here. And we're going to get into the origins of it and everything if you've never heard of it. So don't worry. But Steve, the first thing we like to do when we bring somebody on for the first time is talk a little bit about their secret origin, how they became involved in comics. Did they grow up reading them? You know, what's their kind of their journey, how they became a creator? Because everybody's journey is unique, as you know. That old cliche in comics where nobody gets in the same way. Once somebody figures out a way to break in, they close that door and everybody has to figure out a different way. So what's your secret origin, Steve? Were comics a big part of your childhood? Take us down memory road, as it were, memory lane.
Yeah. As a kid, my first comics were actually war comics. I grew up in the 70s. So, you know, like the Sergeant Fury stuff from Marvel was a big one. Sergeant Rock didn't resonate with me as much. And I think it was probably because I liked the over-the-top qualities of Sergeant Fury. So like as a little kid, like 5 years old, you know, again, back in the 70s when, you know, young boys played war all the time. You know, it just seems like a bizarre world to me, but yeah, you know, that was my childhood growing up. And so, yeah, lots of like Sergeant Fury and stuff like that. It's funny because we would draw comics like around the dining room table, my friends and I, and we all thought that superhero comics were babyish, you know, that those are mature 6-year-old.
Right.
And in about 1974, I think it was, I ended up picking up Avengers 129. It was the cover had Kang the Conqueror on it. And it was the beginning of the Steve Englehart, Sal Buscema, Kang story arc that ran, I think, through like 144 and had like 3 giant size issues in there too. The whole Celestial Madonna storyline.
Right. Yeah, man.
And, you know, my little 9-year-old brain just was blown. It was so cool. And from that point on, it was almost all superhero comics. Although around the same time, like I identified Jack Kirby's artwork from the Sergeant Fury stuff and like Marvel's Greatest Comics, the reprints of the Fantastic Four books. So I recognized him, and I recognized him as the artist, a writer-artist on Commandy over at DC. So, you know, it was all Marvel superheroes and Jack Kirby. That was my formative years.
So when you kind of realized that, hey, you know, the realism of the war comics is great, and we actually have war in the real world, and I could totally see why you would think, superheroes, that's made up for babies. Once you discovered that superhero comics were kind of cool and these are crazy stories, did you go to your friends and try to convince them, or were you kind of like, I'm just going to keep this to myself?
We all kind of made the transition at the same time.
Okay.
And yeah, it was cool. It was, you know, a whole new world. And then, you know, you start to see the broad strokes tie-ins of mythology with like Thor, because right around that time was like when Roy Thomas took over writing and he, you know, killed Balder, and you know, it's like, oh my God, it's just like the mythology.
Yeah,
it wasn't just like the mythology, but it was
a kid, yeah.
Engaged.
So at what point did you start realizing that, hey, there are creators behind this? Maybe that's something I would want to do. Cause it sounds like you and your friends from an early time weren't just consuming the stories, you were creating your own. So at what point did you realize, hey, there are real people making a living at this, and maybe it's something I want to do?
It was like age 9 or 10, literally. I do have a brother that's 9 years older than me. And I think it was through him that, you know, he recognized Kirby. So I, you know, of course, as a kid, you're emulating. So
right.
I'm like, I must like Jack Kirby. You know, that was my big realization. So, you know, it just kind of built from there. And yeah, just very early on, since there were so many of us that drew, I started to develop an appreciation for why I liked, you know, Sal Buscema better when Klaus Janson was inking him on Defenders than, say, Frank Giacoya on Cap or whatever. And it was probably fifth, sixth grade where I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do.
So from those early beginnings, at what point did you start developing Athena Volterra, which is, you know, like I said, your baby, your thing, the thing that you're most associated with? Was it a long process? Was it lightning in a bottle? I mean, we'll talk a little bit about the inspirations you pulled from in a minute, but was she somebody you conceived of early on?
Oh, absolutely not. And in fact, through like high school and my early 20s, comics and art got put on the back burner, and I played in a bunch of bands and stuff like that. And then, you know, I thought, well, if music doesn't work out, I need a safe job. Comics, you know, just they'll welcome me in, no problem. Right. I was an incredibly naive 20 something. I ended up working in role-playing games and finally worked up the nerve to start doing some comic samples in the late 90s. And it was at either Chicago Comic Con or Wizard World Chicago. I think they had changed to Wizard World by this time, but late 90s. And a friend of mine, a few friends and I were in a hotel room just talking about, you know, our comic stuff and samples and everything. And one of them said, you know, what's your dream project? And it's this, you know, Aviatrix and, you know, it's Indiana Jones style adventures and stuff like that. And I had taken the name from, I had been teaching at a park district thing in the Chicago suburbs. And we had an instructor's show. And I had done like a retro space gal as a painting for my, you know, instructor's piece. And I called it Athena Volterra Space Ranger because the name made me laugh.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, at that point, I was like, well, I like this name and I want to build something around it. So I had this kind of in my back pocket for a couple of years that I wanted to do, you know, in my head originally, it was, I saw it as a black and white book, like Mark Schultz's Xenozoic. That was kind of the origins of it. And, you know, a friend said essentially, well, why are you doing samples? Why don't you do the Athena stuff as your sample? And so it just kind of, you know, shifted over from there.
So, and it really could have been anything. You have this great name. You know, if you're pulling from that sort of pulpy era, having a female heroine, you know, adds a whole nother kind of sexy side of it that you can be really great. One of the things I love about Athena is, although she's sexy and, you know, she is feminine, she's not, you know, one of these over the top kind of bad girl, you know, popping out of her clothes kind of thing. She's more realistic. But really, you could have done anything. You could have gone that, you know, that like that original painting and gone down kind of the Buck Rogers inspired kind of sci-fi thing. What made you decide, hey, I'm going to, you know, set her back in the 30s and lean into that part of it, kind of the Indiana Jones that you mentioned kind of adventure. What led to that final decision?
A couple of things, really. The first of which was I really suck at drawing tech. So as much as I, you know, as much as I'm a devotee of like Al Williamson doing Flash Gordon and Alex Raymond doing Flash Gordon, it's not my strong suit.
Right.
And I kind of looked at like the role-playing game jobs that I'd enjoyed during that period. I had done a couple of jobs for West End Games, Indiana Jones line. And, you know, I got to draw deserts and jungle scenes and, you know, exotic temples. And that stuff was a blast, much more so for me than, you know, drawing a rocket ship or a futuristic city and working out all that,
right.
which was definitely something I struggled with. But, you know, drippy trees with Spanish moss hanging down and atmospheric backgrounds of, you know, Skull Island, you know, that kind of thing just really appealed to me.
And when you, when it came time to develop her as a character, because you can go so many different ways. And there's always that trope, especially in the era that you've set her in, you know, you could have gone down that path. We've seen others do it before where supposedly she's the main character and she's the, you know, heroine and she's the strong one, but really she's got that male sidekick that's kind of, you know, always doing the heavy lifting. Right. Athena is not that. Athena is, you know, she could kick my butt. I mean, let's face it. Right. So when it came time to develop her, I mean, were you just like saying, yeah, this is a female Indiana Jones. I want her to be strong. What are some of the other places that you pulled from and maybe even from your own experiences that you said, okay, this is who she's going to be at her core?
Well, from a visual point of view, one of the important things to me was to not be exploitive with it. Mm-hmm. And, I remember in the late 80s, I'm a huge Steve Rude fan, and I waited in line for like 6 hours on a Sunday afternoon at the Chicago Comic Con to get a sketch from him. And I wanted to get Nexus being his independent comic that he does with Baron. I wanted to get Nexus's partner, Sundra. And so I said, I'd like a sketch of Sundra. And he looked at me apprehensively and said, you don't mean like nude or anything, do you? And I said, oh, God, no. And he said, good. I don't think she'd do that. And I always liked the proprietary sense of like protecting his character right. with that. So I think that was always in the back of my head with kind of approaching the character. But when the web strip launched, my friend Paul Daly was handling the script stuff. Paul is a terrific writer and artist. You can find his stuff on highadventurecomics.com. So he's got a couple of strips there. But Paul was writing it originally, and we started to have like different thoughts on where to go. So essentially, he kind of we split amicably, and he's, you know, he took his stories with him and I kind of remastered the early stuff. But I know this is a convoluted answer, but as I was trying to refigure out how to kind of work out her backstory without the contributions Paul had, I had been reading a lot of period fiction at the time, like Cavalier and Clay, and Glenn David Gould's Carter Beats the Devil. And I was fascinated with magicians. And I was like, well, if her dad was a stage magician, that could explain why she has this varied skill set. Mm-hmm. So I started to kind of research stuff on like period magicians. And I also fell in love with the poster art of that idiom. It's really cool. But I think that was a big part of it. And then just integrating some of the aesthetics of like the dialogue of movies of that period, you know, the Thin Man movies and like screwball comedies, where you've got this kind of rapid fire exchange on the dialogue. Obviously, the comic isn't a comedy, but it does have some similarities with that, with the banter when she has, you know, a male associate. And I mean, you can see that kind of thing, the influence of like screwball comedy in how Han Solo and Princess Leia interact, or Indiana Jones and Marion Ravenwood. There's kind of that back and forth. And, you know, once I discovered where it started in movies, that was like a wellspring of inspiration.
So at that point, with Paul having left and you sort of remastering, to use your term, remastering Athena, and then having that sort of period click in, at that point, did you feel like, okay, now I've got her voice down. Cause you know, like you said before, you know, Paul was doing a lot of the scripting and writing. So once you made that connection, did that click her in for you? Cause obviously you already, you know, knew her intimately from a visual and kind of a sequential storytelling aspect. But at that moment, did it click in and you're like, okay, now I've got her voice. Now she's talking to me.
Yeah. I think so. Like during the Paul period, as part of the backstory, you know, that he had done, like she was raised on a ranch and there was a slight cowboy aspect to it. So I do think her dialogue and her voicing kind of changed, in my scripts where it became a little more that kind of mid-Atlantic banter, you know, snappy patter that you get in those kinds of movies. I think that was a big part of it.
Now take us on the journey. Once you kind of took over, you've been at several different publishers. So talk to us kind of about the evolution and some of the challenges that you've had, you know, just being an independent creator who's wanting to get their work out.
Okay. So we originally launched as a webcomic, and that was where we got the Eisner Award nomination. And then we went to print at Ape Entertainment. And right around that time is when Paul left. And Ape Entertainment kind of faded away. And David Hedgecock, who was one of the co-publishers, went to IDW. That was kind of a shift with them. And I was contacted by a guy named Michael Hudson, who had a publishing imprint called Sequential Pulp that Dark Horse was publishing for him. And so we took the book to Dark Horse. And at the time I had already started the remastering process. And I took the original webcomics and the one miniseries we did at Ape Entertainment. And I literally took a copy of my trade and, you know, like tore the spine off and just started to kind of piece together where I thought the stories would be and, you know, sticking pieces of copy paper in between pages with like rough layouts going, okay, I need connective tissue here and doing patches and stuff like that. And that eventually came out through Dark Horse. Now, sadly, Michael passed away unexpectedly from cancer shortly after the release of the book. So Sequential Pulp kind of dissipated from Dark Horse. I was briefly there. And then I had known the Action Lab guys for years because of the Comic Geek Speak message. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's where I had met Sean Pryor and Dave Dwanch and Chad Ciccone and stuff like that. So it was just kind of a natural switch over there at that point.
So when you did this remastering, you know, right before it was printed at Dark Horse, you know, you were talking about basically tearing it all down and still using some of that material, but, you know, inserting your own connective tissue, as you said, what was that like? Did that give you like such a sense of, okay, it was good before and now I'm really, you know, sinking my teeth into it and it's going to be even better? And did your fans from before, your readership from before, did they have that same reaction that, wow, this is even better?
I don't remember anything like that. It was mostly one of those things where I thought, you know, I don't want this artwork to fall out of print. You know, the stuff that I had done with Chad Fidler and Jason Millay. And so I thought, let's cut it up and I'll dialogue it. It'll be like an old Marvel book, right? You know, they dialogue after the fact. It'll be easy. Yeah, it took like a couple of years.
Right.
You know, I had a full-time job too. So the biggest thing that I came out of that experience with was just realizing how I underestimate how long something's going to take. But really I did it as a soft reboot. So the volume after the compendium is called The Volcano Goddess. And it's got a sequence that explains the new backstory. And it's got a sequence where she's actually at a movie premiere and it picks up some of the artwork from the original web strips. So, the implication is that stuff still exists. It just exists on film in her universe. And what really happened is what happened in the compendium. So if you didn't want to buy the compendium, you could still start with Volcano Goddess. That was my idea for kind of the soft reboot. And then really the biggest response reader-wise, like at cons and stuff, has been since we started doing the ongoing series at Action Lab. Just because I wasn't drawing that because I had gone back to school, but I was writing it. And it was a bigger canvas to tell the story on, lots more subplots and stuff like that. And that received a really good response. So I'm really enjoying continuing that bigger storyline.
Yeah. And so you're still at Action Lab, but you're doing the Kickstarter campaign. So explain to us kind of the logistics of that. Does it come out? Will Kickstarter backers get it first? Are the single issues going to come out, for fulfillment first? Like, how does that all work logistically?
To my knowledge, the backers are going to get the books first. Really, the idea behind doing this was I wanted to have a little more control over production of it. And if we could generate more money with the Kickstarter, hopefully I can upgrade the paper quality and stuff like that. Because I really like, I have a background in graphic design and art direction. Mm-hmm. So I really like having cool objects. And the more, care that I can lavish on these books as objects, the happier I'll be. And, the other side of it is, if I fund, my share of the print run, I don't have to buy books from Action Lab, a month before every convention. So Right. That was kind of the idea there. And yeah, it's my understanding that, when the books come in, they'll solicit them. So I'll have a head start on getting everything out to the backers.
Great. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the specific volume that you're offering on the Kickstarter? So what is the Altina Voltaire and Terror on the Orient Express? What is the kind of the elevator pitch of the story? Because it's not just one story, if I'm understanding right. It's kind of this framework or skeleton story on the Orient Express, but there's other tales within. Is that right?
Kind of, yeah. The nature of it being what would have been issues 9, 10, 11, and 12 of the ongoing series. 9 was kind of a transition issue. So the first chapter of the story really is Athena and her love interest, Desmond Forsyth, trying to make it to the train station because she's reuniting with an old friend. And so it's kind of a Planes, Trains, and Automobiles type of framing sequence where they're trying to get there. And as they're driving and stuff, she's telling stories from her past. Hey, this reminds me of blah, blah, blah. So, the first chapter is just kind of 30 pages that have some nice little things to fill in the backstory of the character. But the heart of the trade paperback puts her on the Orient Express and, kind of playing with the all the classic tropes of all the people that have riffed on the Orient Express. People are mysteriously dying. But instead of it being a murderer, we find out fairly early that it's a supernatural creature. And so there's a bit of a murder mystery vibe to it, but there's also a feeling like that kind of claustrophobic paranoia that you get from something like Alien or, The Thing or something like that. And so it's kind of a departure from the other Athena stuff where it's a little more globetrotting and exotic locales because at that point, thinking again of it in terms of the ongoing series, it was kind of a palate cleanser for, a couple of the more indie-like adventures. So that's kind of it in a horribly long elevator pitch.
Well, would you say that this is a good jumping on point if any of our listeners aren't familiar with Athena? Is this a great place for them to jump on? And is there anything that you would want them to know about Athena as a character if this is their first time experiencing the character?
I think it works as a starting point because, you know, that whole prologue, that whole initial chapter, also kind of informs you of various aspects of her backstory. So even though I probably, if I had known we were going to do this just as an OGN, I probably wouldn't have had that chapter in there, but it works really well as kind of a primer and an overview to fill in some of the blanks on the character's backstory. So yeah, but I mean, otherwise, it's not completely dependent on previous continuity. There are references to stuff that's gone before, but it's not like it's totally reliant and you'd be lost. It works as a standalone as well.
Yeah. But you also do have tiers, and we'll talk about the rewards that are available later, but you do have some that where you can go back and get previous material.
Yeah.
As well, yeah. If somebody wants that. Okay. Yeah. Well, like I said, we'll talk about that in a little bit, but I want to touch on the artwork now. You mentioned that you've kind of transitioned over into kind of writing it, and you're collaborating with other artists. So talk to us about how that's been for you to kind of, you know, go hands off with the art. Was that tough for you? Because that's, you know, how you started, and she's your baby. So was that a difficult transition? Or maybe not difficult is the right word, but was that just kind of weird?
Yeah. I really thought it was going to be a lot more difficult, but Action Lab proposed this idea at a time when I was going back to school, and they said, you know, we'll license the book from you and you can write it and do, you know, whatever you want to do, but we'll get someone else to draw it and we'll be able to do it as a monthly ongoing series. There were some delays, so it didn't work out quite that way, delays at the publisher end, but yeah, it was pretty cool because the first story arc, The Sorcerer Pope, they paired me with a terrific artist named Ishmael Canales. And I've since become friends with Ishmael, and we did a creator-owned book on Kickstarter in 2019 and 2020 called The Catch. And so that was fantastic, hooking up with him. And the second arc was drawn by Yusuf Idris, and then this current arc, the main artist on it is Abel Cicero. And the great thing about working with so many different artists is it gives me an opportunity to rethink how I'm going to tackle the character when I come back, which is going to be the next volume, because I'm done with school, so I'm ready to hop back in the saddle. But yeah, just looking at how everybody stages stuff has been really informative for me to kind of see how they're visualizing what I'm saying and see how I can up my game. So I'm really excited to go back to drawing it as well.
When you say up your game, do you mean up your game when you get back to drawing it? Or are you talking about upping your game as a writer? I imagine working with various artists kind of helps you grow as a writer as well, right?
Yeah, I was thinking primarily as an artist, but yeah, as a writer, I do feel like, yeah, working with different artists also kind of educates me on that. I'm a pretty bare bones kind of writer. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough that the first professional script I got to see, a friend of mine knows Mark Schultz. Again, I mentioned him earlier with Xenozoic. He's written a bunch of like Predator and Alien stuff for Dark Horse. Mm-hmm. And I contacted Mark through my friend and got a Predator script for him, the underwater adventure, Hell in High Water, that Gene Colan drew. And I was amazed at how open his script was. And after I had done the samples and sent them to him, we had a long phone conversation, and he was very generous about, you know, critiquing my work. But I asked him about how he laid out his script, and he said, well, as an artist, I don't want to dictate to someone else how to draw a particular scene. I just need to convey the important information about the scene and then let them compose it and play to their strengths. And so that's how I try to write, you know, for myself or for someone else, because I felt like Mark made a lot of sense with that.
Was that a challenge at all as a writer? Because I have to imagine that as you're writing this, you're thinking, well, this is how, you know, my writer brain is writing it, and my artist brain is going, and this is how I would draw it. Was there like an adjustment period to go, okay, leave the writer brain alone or leave the artist brain alone and don't actually put any of that direction in there?
Yeah, like on the second pass through it, I was able to kind of look at it and go, okay, this is too much information, stuff like that. So it helped. But there was one sequence in the second story arc that Yusuf Idris drew called The Golden Dawn, where there was a really complicated motorcycle chase and fight scene mm-hmm. across layered rope bridges. And I may have built a little bit of a diorama, not so much to show him how to compose it, but to just explain, okay, this guy's on this bridge. There's a bridge that crisscrosses under it.
Right. So
I photographed it, and then I did little arrows. And by diorama, I really mean it was like a small box with a piece of tape, scotch tape that, you know, designated the rope bridge, stuff like that. But that was the most involved I got with anything, just to try to explain how the structure worked. But I left the layout up to him.
Now, as the writer part, this is what's so interesting, and I hear especially people that do both, like yourself, because the people that don't, they'll just write the craziest, you know, scene, and it's got 100 characters, and they're doing all kinds of crazy stuff, horses, and you know, things that cars that, you know, traditionally artists can have a tough time with. And the writer's over here going, "You want me to do what? This page is going to take me 3 days." Does it help that you're aware of those things, or do you forget about that sometimes and then not realize until you get the pages in and go, "Oh man, I really kind of made them stretch their muscles there."
That's one of my strengths. I feel like I'm pretty good about not, gosh, I'm trying to think of some of the script things that I've gotten in before where it's like, establishing shot, aerial view. We see someone walking out of a cabin, and inside the cabin is, you know, someone else. Yeah. It's an aerial view. We can kind of see the person coming out, but I can't get into the cabin. Or,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there's soup cooking on the stove and crackers on the cabin. Like, what?
Just, yeah, extraneous stuff. So I've been pretty good about not really doing a lot of that. Excuse me. But I know that sometimes I phrase it in a way, like when I do my second pass, I'll be like trying to keep the tense consistent so that I'm writing everything in present tense and describing so-and-so is doing this rather than surprised. So-and-so turned and looked, just trying to make sure that it all seems like it's taking one particular sliver of time in the present tense and laying it all out, if that makes any sense. It made when I thought it.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And it goes along to what we were talking about earlier. You want to always continue to strive to improve, you know, and evolve as a writer and, you know, as an artist as well. Well, listeners, I want to let everybody know that Steve's campaign is already funded. So this is another one of the situations where, you know, if you pledge, you're going to get it. You know, it's not one of those situations where maybe it's fulfilled. You know, maybe the campaign is fulfilled, maybe not. So you don't know if you're going to get the book. You're going to get the book. So how has the campaign gone, Steve? And how long did it take you to hit the fulfillment goal?
We were funded in 3.5 days, which was just crazy because almost everything else I've done has been kind of a white knuckle ride into the last 24, 48 hours.
Right.
So it was really gratifying because it's the biggest number I've shot for on a campaign. So that was fantastic. the thing is with, I have noticed the more money you raise, the more cancellations you get throughout the campaign as well. Right. It, you know, it's just, I probably proportionate to, you know, the amount of money flying around, you're going to have a lot more cancellations. So it's just the nature of it. So that, that can be a little jarring when you look and you're like, so-and-so canceled a $250, you know, pledge, but you know, it's nothing personal. It just, it happens. But yeah, it's been really cool in that like we reached our funding goal. We have two stretch goals we've already knocked down. And I'm also doing backer goals so that at 100 backers, I threw in a digital sketchbook at 150, audio commentary at 200. I expanded the digital sketchbook. I think we've got 5 backer goals knocked down already, and we're like 20 some backers away from our 6th. So, you know, adding things like audio commentaries and just expanding that digital sketchbook.
Yeah. And really just, you know, more bang for the buck for everybody who pledges. So as you're listening to this, everyone, as it's being released, there's about 2 weeks left. It's going to end on February 25th at 10:42 a.m. Pacific time. So you have a week and a day to go and check it out. And again, link in the show notes. You can go click there or just do a Google search for Athena Voltaire and the Terror on the Orient Express, and you'll find it. Steve, why don't you let our listeners know what are some of the rewards? Because as we mentioned earlier, there is a way to go back and get previous Athena Voltaire material.
Yeah. We've got a digital library or individual digital volumes that you can get. You can also get them in print. There's a package for the entire library up till that point, including the new volume. You can get the book signed, or for $15 more, you can get it. You can get the book itself, or for $15 more, you can get it signed with a sketch on the title page. Probably my favorite thing on there is I've got two different box sets. We did these box sets for the Catch Kickstarter campaigns. And, you know, it's a pretty elaborate box. It's in the Kickstarter video where I open it up and you can see it's printed on all sides. And you get a trade and you get all four of what would have been the individual issues and a set of pilot's wings. And I've got a weather alert in the background. I'm sorry.
We're good.
Okay, good. That's going to be quiet. Sorry about that. And it's got like metal pilot wings and a 64 page volume called the Creator's Edition, where you've got the script on the left and the black and white art on the right. So you can kind of compare how it's broken down. That's one of the box sets. The other one is the mystery box, where it's the trade, a mystery piece of 6x9 artwork that I've done for like Inktober, and two comics that I've either written, drawn, or written and drawn. And a couple pieces of like promo swag, buttons, bookmarks, postcards, that kind of stuff. So yeah, I found those things are fun. We've got 3 different t-shirt designs. One is Voltaire Aviation. Another one is kind of in the style of old propaganda posters, where it says, Athena Voltaire says, do your part, always punch Nazis. That's probably my favorite shirt.
I love that. Yeah,
lots of goofy stuff like that.
The other thing that I love about this, and it probably speaks to how quickly you were funded, is, you know, here you came up with this idea for a character and a strip, started as web, you know, got with that great Comics Geek Speak community, and then had through no fault of your own, you know, to move publishers a couple of times just because, you know, life happens.
Right.
All along, it feels like you've had this Athena Voltaire community not only going on the adventures with you in the books, but following you along from publisher to publisher, and probably following you along to you know, support this Kickstarter. So can you talk a little bit about the Athena Voltaire community? You know, are there fans that you see? You know, obviously there were no conventions last year, but are there Athena Voltaire fans that you see, you know, it, a lot of the same faces coming over, you know, at various shows you do and saying, hey, you know, we love the book. Talk a little bit about to us about the community.
I am stupid lucky. That's really the bottom line, because, yeah, I've had people that have been incredibly patient waiting for the book. I'll have certain people I see every year at San Diego Comic-Con, certain people I see every year in Chicago at C2E2 or, yeah, various shows. And it's been really gratifying. And I do like to ask people, you know, where did you hear about the book? And frequently it's, you know, Comic Geek Speak or 11 O'Clock Comics or Word Balloon. And yeah, I'm always gratified by, you know, the relationship that I've developed with people just because some kind people have helped promote my book. So it's been pretty great. And everybody seems really patient about the fact that, you know, they know that it's not a paying gig. So it's something that, you know, I'm working on after hours or, you know, insanely early before, you know, before work and stuff like that. And they seem to just appreciate the fact that it's a labor of love for me. So that's incredibly gratifying.
Yeah, I'm sure. And as my listeners know, because we say it all the time, nobody gets into comics because they say, I want to be rich. I'm going to do comics. I'm sure, Steve, you would love to be making $1 million and be doing Athena Voltaire full time. And then you could put out, you know, monthly or even more material than that. But it's to your credit and your love of the character that you've been doing it for as long as you have, and you're still committed to, you know, putting it out, you know, as time permits.
Yeah, it's something that I really enjoy doing, and taking the time off to, you know, finish my undergrad and grad school. You know, the idea being, when the pandemic's over, I would love to shift over to teaching full time, which would give me more time in the summer to go on the road and promote the book, and more time to make the book. So, you know, that's kind of the game plan with that. But yeah, until then, it is one of those things of, it's just a labor of love, and it's stories I want to tell. And having been away from it for a couple of years and just been a writer on it, I'm just chomping at the bit to start drawing the arc that comes after Terror on the Orient Express.
Well, great. We look forward to that. And congratulations on the Kickstarter funding so quickly. Again, everybody, there's a link in the show notes to the Kickstarter campaign. You can go click there and check it out. If anybody wants to follow you on social media, Steve, to know when things are going on, you know, obviously convention appearances and such, when those come back, where's the best place to engage with you online?
Twitter is probably the best, but Twitter, Facebook, and my sorely neglected Instagram are all just Steve Bryant Art. So it's STEVEBRYANT, and then the word art, ART, no spaces.
Great. And I'll put links to those social media accounts in the show notes as well, everybody. So Steve, it's been great chatting with you. Best of luck with Athena Voltaire in the future. And I look forward. I haven't yet backed, but as soon as we're done talking, I'm going to go back. You have convinced me. You got me with the whole Planes, Trains, and Automobiles thing. I can't wait to see the Athena Voltaire, you know, version of that. So again, thanks for joining me. It's been great chatting with you.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And listeners, thanks to you for joining us as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.